other UK universities are equally implicated. The University of Glasgow admitted it had received more than $258 million from people who derived their wealth from slavery, while the University of Bristol estimated that 85% of the wealth used to found the university depended on slave labor, according to Reuters. On both sides of the Atlantic, US and European universities were founded on the profits made from transatlantic slave trades and the lucrative business of colonialism. In these universities, the children of slave traders and colonial officers were educated, and indeed indoctrinated, in the validity of their conquest and in the political culture and moral depravity that sustained this Sikh tradition. What do we do now? Admitting mea culpa is, of course, necessary but not sufficient. Revelations that top American and universities in the Europe were heavily invested in slavery, benefited from the slave trade, and were institutional advocates of colonialism is a major event in the history of higher education. But what exactly needs to be done once such revelations are widely publicized? Allocation of resources to diversify the student and faculty body to include the descendants of the impoverished, robbed, and denigrated communities, Black people, Native Americans, Latins, and students and faculty from across the colonial world is, of course, an absolute must. While Western universities are today quite cognizant of the disenfranchised communities in their midst and seek to recruit more from these communities, this does not apply to students from around the world subject to their colonial and imperial violence. This is a serious shortcoming. Students and scholars from Asia, Africa, and Latin America, where the EU and US have been definitive to their national miseries, must be given particular attention. Today, Afghan and Iraqi students in particular need to be given financial resources for their higher education in American and European universities. But what exactly are these students and scholars to study or teach in these universities? Further indoctrination in white supremacist curricula. The urgent task of remedying the horrors of the past must include serious reconsideration of the future of college curricula. Meaningful reparations can only occur when the history of racism, slavery, and colonialism is brought to the forefront inside European and American university classrooms. But today, even the body of scholarship produced under the rubric of critical race theory or intersectionality is under attack by reactionary forces in Europe and the US. Private universities, at the mercy of political pressure, could never lead the way, except within the conservative context determined by their wealthy donors, which continue to oppose any serious curricular changes. This is where the global media is an equally, if not even more, changes. This is where the global media is an equally, if not even more, crucial public sphere where such changes can be inaugurated. Consider when the New York Times launched two crucial projects, the 1619 Project on the History of Slavery and the Haiti Ransom Project on French colonialism in Haiti. To be sure, these two seminal projects are based on generations of scholarship. but such a scholarship does not easily translate into curricular changes. Western civilization continues to be the code word for the sustained indoctrination of successive generations of students, who are kept critically unaware, not just of other civilizations, but also of the troubling origins of civilizational thinking. Nothing enduring or significant follows so long as we have curricular apartheid in the world, with Western civilization receiving preferential treatment and enormous resources, while other civilizations, cultures, and accompanying suffering are delegated to the poorly financed periphery. Today, issues of environmental justice, mass refugees, labor migration, and the organically changing character of world cultures are far more crucial to understand than a fake and forced emphasis on Western civilization. Today, the most racist white supremacist political movements are sustained and agitated by false assumptions about the uniqueness and superiority of Western civilization, to which elite universities remain committed. There is no redressing the sustained history of US and European universities' involvement with slavery, racism, and colonialism without first dismantling its sustained ideological premise.
Hello everyone, and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent.
The Subcontinent.
Hello everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent. On this program, we will address the most important issues in the South Asian region that affect the governments, organizations, communities, and most importantly, the people. And as always, we will dissect the issues and present you with different perspectives from experts and people. So stay tuned.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we will discuss the expansion of bilateral ties between Iran and Bangladesh in line with the Ebrahim Raisi government's neighborhood first policy. And we shall also take a look at how the toxic wave of Islamophobia continues to haunt Indian Muslims, preventing Muslim women from securing jobs and livelihood.
The 20th ministerial meeting of the developing eight countries, which includes the Islamic Republic of Iran, was hosted by Bangladesh this week. The meeting, focusing primarily on food and energy security, tourism and trade, provided an opportunity for Tehran and Dhaka to revitalize their relations and broaden the scope of their economic and cultural cooperation. Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian's discussions with Bangladeshi officials were in line with the Iranian government's policy of expanding cooperation with countries in the region.
Foreign Minister Amir Abdollahian's virtual address to the D8 summit was timed well, at a time when the Ebrahim Raisi government is looking to boost relations with regional countries in line with its neighborhood first policy. Given the scope that exists between Iran and Bangladesh for expansion of cooperation in various spheres, the top Iranian diplomat used the opportunity to call for cooperation between developing countries and creation of an efficient economic system. The two countries have made strenuous efforts in recent years to take their traditional relations to a higher level. In a congratulatory message to his Bangladeshi counterpart on the country's Independence Day on March 26, President Raisi said the amicable relations between Iran and Bangladesh should be developed and deepened further. He expressed hope that the two countries will witness greater cooperation and collaboration in areas of mutual interest. While Iran and Bangladesh share time-tested cultural relations, they have also made efforts in recent years to boost their trade and economic cooperation. In July 2006, the two countries signed a preferential trade accord, but its activation was severely affected by U.S. sanctions on Iran. Iranian officials have often noted the unsatisfactory level of trade cooperation between the two sides, expressing readiness to engage deeply and sincerely.
Relations between Iran and Bangladesh go back centuries when it was still known as Bengal. However, since Bangladesh's independence in 1971, relations between the two countries have largely ebbed and flowed. From initial frostiness due to Iran's strong ties with Pakistan to Dhaka and Tehran becoming close allies, the two sides have come a long way. In recent years, with Dhaka showing particular interest in developing strategic ties with Middle Eastern nations, the attention has gradually shifted to its relationship with Iran, a key regional player.
Iran's relations with Bangladesh date back to the 14th century, when it was a sovereign state that encompassed present-day Bangladesh, the Indian state of West Bengal, and the Burmese state of Rakhine. Iranian immigrants played a key role in the Sultanate, as Persian was the official language. Over the centuries, Bengal witnessed a massive influx of Iranian scholars, lawyers, teachers, and clerics in search of employment, as well as to propagate Islam. Politically, in the early 1970s, after a few years of frostiness in bilateral ties, relations between Tehran and Dhaka improved after Iran recognized Bangladesh. Pakistan recognized the country in 1974 ahead of the second OIC summit in Lahore, which was followed by Iran and Turkey. The relations particularly improved after the Islamic Revolution in 1979. In 2007, Iran assisted Bangladesh with aid after the country was hit by Cyclone Sidr. Iran has also served as a key partner in developing Bangladeshi oil fields in the northeastern region of Sylhet. It has also offered to rebuild the country's sole state-owned oil refinery, Eastern Refinery, which was constructed in 1963 with Iran's help. In terms of bilateral trade, Iran can buy jute, ready-made garments, leather goods, tea, and agricultural products from Bangladesh, while it can export oil, natural gas, petrochemicals, plastics, and ceramics.
Now, to have more insight, we are joined by Mr. Bhattacharjee, journalist and author from India. He has been a foreign affairs writer for close to two decades and has reported on Bangladesh on multiple occasions. Now, Mr. Bhattacharjee, first of all, welcome to the program. Now, how significant do you see Foreign Minister Hussein Amir Abdollahian's virtual participation in the context of efforts by Tehran and Dhaka to revitalize their bilateral relations?
Well, you have to really put the visit in the coming context of the visit of the D8 ministerial meeting that is going to take place in Dhaka. And this is a meeting which is coming at a crucial time when the world is more or less waking up to the importance of Bangladesh as a stabilizing factor in a world where the forces of disruption are at work. So this is a very critical moment, and this is also a moment of recognition of the importance of Bangladesh, and this is a symbolic moment in the sense that Bangladesh is more or less being welcomed for the initiatives that it is taking at home, whether be in the field of connectivity or in the field of greater law and order actions against extremism and terrorism that are getting a lot of support from neighboring countries like India. So I would say that in the larger context of regional as well as global developments, I would say the visit is coming at a time when both sides may have substantial issues on the table.
Sir, as we know, Iran and Bangladesh have shared traditional cultural ties. So my question is, why have the two countries not been able to exploit the full potential of their trade and economic cooperation?
Well, the answer to begin with is that stars previously probably were not aligned to help the two countries come closer. As you know very well, in today's world, even strictly bilateral relations are also supported and facilitated sometimes because of regional and global developments. And the two countries are coming together at a time when the world is more or less in a phase of post-pandemic recovery. And of course, you know, the world is also dealing with the post-Ukraine war disruption of commodities, which is being described as the period of commodity shock. So both Iran and Bangladesh are important players at a time when the world is going through these seismic changes. And therefore, I would say that now it appears that the stars are aligned, because you have to remember that Russia is an important player in this period. And both the countries, that is Dhaka as well as Tehran, the two capitals of Iran and Bangladesh, are close partners of Russia. And you remember that the Nuripur nuclear power reactor that Russia is building in Bangladesh is one of the largest nuclear power projects that Russia is building anywhere in the world. And this power project is likely to be completed in the next 1 and 1.5 years. So just like, you know, Iran, which has benefited from the nuclear energy of Russia, you have now Bangladesh getting on the same boat. And Bangladesh is, of course, getting on that boat because of its very, very steep energy requirement. So I would say that there is also the Russian factor, which is bringing the two sides closer. And then, of course, you know, Iran has its troubled relationship with the West, with the United States. And Sheikh Hasina's government in the last few weeks has seen several ups and downs with the Western countries that are increasing pressure on Bangladesh because of democracy, human rights, and freedom of expression. And Sheikh Hasina herself has made certain comments that have indicated that the Prime Minister is probably looking for new partners. And if that be the case, then perhaps I would say that truly the stars are better aligned this time to bring the two countries together.
So you think the time is right for Tehran and Dhaka to reactivate their preferential trade agreement, which has been put on the back burner due to U.S. sanctions?
Well, you have to really look at trade in the present critical condition of the disruption that the world economy is undergoing. And I think the preferential trade agreement needs to be forward-looking, especially because it was the product of a particular age when things were very different from what it is at present. You know, the Russians were not assertive back then, and they are assertive right now. So the world's market has changed dramatically. So you'll have to really reorient it and look at the future requirements of both sides, and then move ahead and create a preferential trade agreement that will serve both sides, rather than just going back to the trade agreement and trying to restart it in its original form. I think the two countries really need to come on board because of the energy requirement that Bangladesh at present has, because Bangladesh is going through an acute phase of energy crisis that it needs to deal with at an emergency basis. So I think Iran can help Bangladesh considerably on that front, and Bangladesh can provide some critical diplomatic support at the United Nations and in other fronts. And I think it can be a good win-win situation for both sides.
Mr. Bhattacharjee, thank you for being on the program. Now, let's see how people have reacted on social media.
In a tweet, Iran's foreign ministry quotes the country's top diplomat, Hossein Amir Abdollahian, telling the D8 summit in Bangladesh that economic diplomacy and closer ties with neighboring countries are two of Iran's foreign policy priorities. Salah Sedinri, a Dhaka-based economic analyst, says the organization of D8 countries today has the trade potential of $500 billion. Marking a six-fold jump from 2017, when it stood at around $15 billion. Bangladeshi journalist Masood Karim notes that with a combined population of more than 1.1 billion people from 8 developing economies of the Muslim world, D8 is a unique cross-regional intergovernmental organization stretching from Southeast Asia to Africa.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
The growing tide of Hindu nationalism and toxic Islamophobia has dangerously manifested in India under the present ruling dispensation, with a tsunami of hate speeches, attacks on religious places, desecration of religious symbols, and abuse of religious freedom. It's become an open season against Muslims in the world's largest democracy. Now, according to reports, serious obstacles have emerged in the way of Muslim women in the private sector market in India, with rampant discrimination and racism preventing them from landing jobs.
Each day brings new challenges for minority Muslims in Hindu-majority India as the country slowly slides toward Hindu-majoritarianism. Islamophobia in India enables violence, hate, subjugation, intimidation, and blatant discrimination against Muslims, who make up roughly 15% of the country's 1.35 billion population.
This Islamophobic Sarkar is trying to deny our right. We want our right and freedom. And we will fight for our last minute of our life. And this is for us, and this is for our community, and this is for our all Indian citizens, our citizenship right.
A recent study by Led-By Foundation, a leadership incubator for India's most disadvantaged women, reveals serious impediments for Muslim women in securing jobs in the country's burgeoning private sector. The research found that for every 2 callbacks that a Hindu woman receives from private sector firms, a Muslim woman gets only 1. According to the study, the net discrimination rate of 47.1% for Indian Muslim women compared to Hindu women proves the significant hiring bias and prejudice against Indian Muslim women across industries and geographies. The damning report reveals how the Muslim community, especially Muslim women, continues to be underrepresented in the formal job market. The report comes in the wake of calls for an economic boycott of Muslim vendors, daily wagers, craftsmen, and other service providers by fanatics associated with the ruling Bharatiya Janata Party. It shows that recruiters think of Muslim women as less capable of jobs that they are fully qualified for.
India's minority Muslim community has encountered decades of discrimination and racism, which has assumed alarming proportions under Narendra Modi's Hindu nationalist BJP government in the last 8 years. Under Modi, Muslims have been othered and reduced to second-class citizens. As per conservative estimates, around 80% of India's Muslim population today comprises Pasmanda, a Persian word for those left out. These people lag behind on economic, social, and political parameters, with no voice, no representation, and no agency.
The Hindu nationalist BJP has been accused of not giving adequate representation to Muslims in India. Notably, the party now has no Muslim among its 395 members of parliament after the term of former minister Mukhtar Abbas Naqvi ended in early July. Lack of representation and opportunities, though, isn't limited to politics. The malaise permeates all sectors of the public and private sectors. It also isn't an issue that pertains only to men. Women have been equally dispossessed and driven out of different spheres where they have had the opportunity to excel. Muslim women have also been at the receiving end for asserting their identity and freedom of choice. They have been forced to give up hijab. They have been auctioned online. They have been denied jobs. They have been put in jails. Their houses have been bulldozed. yet they have stood firm and refused to be bullied or intimidated. The lack of representation in the job sector, as revealed by the Led By Foundation study, is another eye-opener. It says the overall participation of Muslims in union government departments is abysmally low at all levels. It also adds that the unemployment of Muslims in universities, banks, and public sector undertakings is also low.
Now, to talk more on this, we are joined by Mrs. Mirali, the editor of the Longview magazine from London, UK. First of all, welcome to the program, Mrs. Mirali. Now, according to a report, serious impediments have been created for Muslim women in India in securing public and private sector jobs. Now, do you see it as part of the toxic wave of Islamophobia and racism?
There are really long-standing problems in India with regard to, amongst other things, gender issues and the treatment of minorities. And what we see here is the continued coalescence of the two with regard to Muslim women. So, yes, there is definitely a toxic wave of Islamophobia, a very strong vein of it, current of it, running through India at the moment. But this is not particularly a recent thing. So it's part and parcel of it, but there are many other aspects to it. And I would say, arguably, that this is has got much longer and deeper roots.
Mr. Mirali, now under the Narendra Modi government in India, Muslims have been othered and virtually left out of the system. So could we say that this has damaged the country's rich secular democratic fabric?
So I have some issues with the framing of India as having a rich secular democratic fabric. I know this is a great idea that's been promoted for a long time, but really, as we've discussed before and in other places, there have been a lot of deep-rooted problems, communitarian problems, sectarian problems, problems of racism, and of which Islamophobia is just one, in India since partition, since independence, that have never been looked at, that have just simply been allowed to ossify at the social level and are completely embedded within the structures and systems of the Indian state. So, yes, there has been more damage under the BJP, but the BJP themselves are an outcome of this system. You know, they're not something that ran counter to it. They're very much a product of it. And until we really disentangle this, until people within India and outside of India start really discussing some of these problems, which are in some ways not even just India specific, they are to do with the post-colonial settlements around the world, particularly from the British Empire, but not only that, we're not going to get progress. We're going to keep seeing repeat cycles of extreme violence, extreme racism, extreme Islamophobia, and then a normalization settling down of some lower levels of discrimination, Islamophobia, and then another spike, and so on and so forth.
Last but not least, Miss, how has India changed over the past 8 years of the BJP government, and where do you see the country 10 years down the line?
You get now very openly, blatantly discriminatory laws and policies. I think this is one of the key differences. Whereas before, you may have more subtle forms of exclusion and marginalization and otherization, and I use the word subtle in inverted commas. What you now have is a kind of blatant call to aggression against Muslims. So you will see that high-ranking politicians, people within those networks of the BJP, and to be honest, even other political parties kind of in their wider networks, are being caught out, making extraordinarily violent speeches, claims against Muslims. You have endless conversations now trending about the justifications of cracking down on Muslims, discriminating against Muslims, even killing Muslims because on XYZ spurious basis, you know, things like fictions like Love Jihad, where there's a claim that Muslim men are going around seducing Hindu women and getting them converted to Islam. And these kind of what you can only describe as ridiculous narratives, which are then being used to justify these attitudinal changes in society, which again then means that more laws can be changed, more policies can be enacted. And what you have is then a distraction from the big problems that face India, the kind of increasing issues around wealth redistribution, about the way it has industrialized and the economy has grown in some ways, but then still left people in abject poverty, the decimation of the agricultural sector, etc. And none of these are being looked at. So what we get now is a kind of catastrophic collapse within India of both the economic and social fabric. This is very much kind of accelerated under the BJP, but at the same time has been masked by these kind of very rabid rhetorics and narratives. I don't want to be prophesying any kind of doom and gloom. I'm a believer, and I pray and I hope that things in 10 years' time will be for the better.
On that note, I would like to thank Mrs. Mirali for her precious time and knowledge. Now, let's see how people have reacted on social media.
The Bridge Initiative, a project to counter Islamophobia at Georgetown University, asserts that Islamophobia in India has corroded what was once the world's largest democracy, with laws that once belonged to South Africa's apartheid now popping up across the South Asian country. Samiullah Khan, a journalist and human rights activist, cites the mob lynching case of an 18-year-old Muslim youth who was killed by extremist Hindus in the southern Indian state of Karnataka to stress that the tide of Islamophobia is rising in India. Law professor and author Khaled Beydoun says Hindutva leaders are paying women to frame Muslim businessmen in rape cases, targeting prominent business and community leaders, calling it another vile dimension of Islamophobia in India.
And that was our episode about Iran's growing ties with Bangladesh and the grave problem of Islamophobia in India. We shall meet again next week. So till then, take good care. ليش تأخر عباس من البيان يا حسين من زوري وشاف الراس ثانيا ناديا ليش تأخر عباس Mournful is the earth as heaven starts to cry. Water doubts its worth as lips begin to dry. Listen to the silence. It breaks with a sad goodbye. Amid the drums of war is a mother's lullaby.
In the limelight.
Joe Biden's trip to Palestine in July served as yet another message to the Palestinian people that the Israeli regime is working hand in hand with the U.S., says Mitchell Plitnik, author, in an article published under the heading, Biden Administration Continues to Disregard the Palestinian People. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. When Joe Biden won the 2020 election, little was expected of him regarding the struggle for Palestinian rights. He had the advantage of replacing Donald Trump, who had surpassed his predecessors in supporting extreme Israeli regime goals, so he was bound to look good by comparison. Being better than Trump is an extremely low standard, and while Biden has met it, he has been better than Trump only by the thinnest of margins. In fact, Biden has managed to fail to meet even the lowest expectations he himself set. While he has not taken major steps in the Zionist regime's favor as Trump did, the day-to-day lives of Palestinians continue to deteriorate under his watch. His upcoming trip to the occupied Palestinian territories and the West Bank in July is unlikely to change that. The rhetoric coming out of the Biden administration has been as consistent as it has been empty. They have consistently stated that they support a two-state solution and they want to take steps to ensure equal measures of freedom, security, prosperity, and dignity to Palestinians. But the administration's actions directly belie that statement. The absence of any attempt even to seriously discuss Palestinian rights with the Zionist regime demonstrates that clearly. And the specific examples are too numerous to list. Recently, the United States rejected a Palestinian Authority request to restart peace talks based on the 1967 borders. That should comport with Biden administration policy, but they refused based on the precarious political situation in the occupied territories where the coalition government has lost key votes, is now in the minority, and is fraying quickly. A Palestinian source told the Israeli regime daily, Haaretz, that they, meaning the Americans, talk as if only Israel has a cabinet and public opinion that has to be considered. What about Palestinian opinion? And what about the aggression against Palestinians? The American attitude about aggression toward Palestinians couldn't be clearer than it has been since the Zionist regime's killing of Al Jazeera journalist Shirin Abu Aghila. Despite at least four independent, fully transparent investigations by CNN, the Associated Press, Bellingcat, and most recently, the Washington Post, the Biden administration continues to call for an independent, transparent investigation, which is clearly code for an Israeli one. The Biden team has simply dismissed the eyewitness testimony of Palestinians who were with or near Shirin when she was killed, for no apparent reason aside from their being Palestinian. No doubt, Biden will, during his July visit to Beit Lahm, rebuff Palestinian inquiries about the killing and simply repeat to the Israelis that they want a transparent, independent investigation. Instead of addressing the apartheid conditions and daily severe human rights violations Palestinians are continuing to endure, the Biden administration tossed crumbs to the Palestinian Authority by, for example, upgrading the Palestinian Affairs Unit to the U.S. Office of Palestinian Affairs and having it report directly to the State Department rather than to the U.S. Embassy. Biden has made it clear that he will not take steps to undo the damage Trump did by moving the embassy to Al-Quds, nor will he revoke the United States' illegal recognition of the Zionist regime's sovereignty over the Golan Heights. The administration is, on the other hand, laser-focused on expanding the Abraham Accords and plans to use this trip to move Saudi-Israeli regime relations forward toward normalization. Biden insisted that the planned meeting with Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, who Biden once called a pariah, was not about energy prices, but this is an obvious lie. Biden will go to MBS, hat in hand, and plead for lower energy prices and cooperation with the fake regime of Israel. But the Saudi king Salman remains opposed to normalization with the Zionist regime outside the framework of the 2002 Arab Peace Initiative, and the Saudis are already coordinating with the Zionist regime on security matters. So Biden is demeaning himself for what will likely be no reason, as OPEC has already announced plans to increase oil production in July and August, an increase which is likely to be reversed in time for the U.S. primary elections in November. Meanwhile, the Palestinian people face an ever-tightening occupation, yet one would see no indication of this in Washington. If Biden and Secretary of State Antony Blinken started their term reluctant to rock the Israeli boat, they're now terrified that anything they do that plays poorly in the occupied territories risks toppling the cabinet of Naftali Bennett and could lead to the return of Benjamin Netanyahu. With Democrats already poised to lose big in the midterms and Biden's popularity at historic lows, they don't want an Israeli regime prime minister who will actively work with Republicans to further diminish the Democrats' position. That means throwing the Palestinians even further under the bus. It means ignoring settlement expansion, the increasing violence of settlers and the Israeli troops and police, and congressional letters calling for the president to try to stop the mass evictions of Palestinians in Masafer Yatah. And it certainly means turning a blind eye to the ongoing apartheid. Biden's trip in July is not likely to do much for him or for the United States, but it will be yet another message to the Palestinian people that the Zionist regime is working hand in hand with the United States. And whether a Democrat or a Republican is in the White House, that isn't going to change.
hidden files.
Well, there's a distinct and qualitative difference between one breaking a law for one's own individual self-interest or violating it in the interests of a class or a people whose oppression is expressed either directly or indirectly through that particular law. Well, the former might be called a criminal, though in many instances he is a victim. But the latter, as a reformist or revolutionary, is interested in universal social change. Captured, he or she is a political prisoner. Well, this is an excerpt from writings by former political prisoner, black revolutionary activist, and professor, Dr. Angela Davis. Hello, and welcome to Hidden Files. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Well, you heard the definition of who is a political prisoner, according to this philosopher and activist. But the United States denies ever having any political prisoners. There are hundreds, if not thousands, of individuals who've been incarcerated in the U.S. over the decades who would say otherwise. Now, some of them have now died in prison. Some have been released, and others are still incarcerated after being in prison for more than 4 decades. Well, many of these individuals were involved in revolutionary movements in the 1960s. At the time, most of the activists were teenagers or in their 20s. Imagine that. Now, they say that they were fighting against settler colonialism and oppression. Now, these individuals are elderly in their 60s, 70s, and even 80s. They have endured many decades in prison and have spent much of their time even in solitary confinement. Many of them are ill, and lawyers have petitioned for them to be released on the basis of compassion. However, the U.S. is still adamant about keeping them behind bars. Why?
Why American authorities felt that the Black Panthers were such a threat, and the reason why the U.S. destroyed this group and many other black nationalist groups. What exactly were they demanding? They wanted freedom and the power to determine the destiny of black and oppressed communities. The group believed that self-determination was key to ending their oppression, and they wanted to control the institutions in their communities. The Black Panthers were also seeking full employment for African Americans and other people of color. Due to the fact that black communities had been exploited for hundreds of years, the group wanted an end to the theft by the capitalist system of black people. They believed that the U.S. government was racist and prevented black Americans from excelling. They demanded what was promised to them after slavery, and that was 40 acres of land and 2 mules, or the financial equivalent of it. The Black Panthers wanted decent housing for black people and other minorities. Housing which was fit to live in. And the group was also demanding that decent education be provided to black Americans. They wanted what they called true history to be taught, which meant exposing the true nature of American imperialism, as well as teaching the reality of how black Americans had been exploited and how they contributed to society. The Black Panthers were looking at many aspects of life, including health, and they wanted free health care for all black and oppressed people. And they wanted preventive medicine to be practiced in oppressed communities. One of the first demands of the Black Panthers was an end to police brutality and the murder of black people and other oppressed people inside the United States. The Black Panthers were very aware of the connection between their own oppression and the oppression of others. Thus, they wanted an end to all wars of aggression by the United States. They said the goal of these wars was to expand domination and the oppression of people around the world. The organizations wanted the freedom for all black and oppressed people being held in all U.S. prisons. The Panthers felt that to begin with, their incarceration was due to the racist and oppressive system. And they also believed that any trials held for alleged crimes should be done so in front of a jury of peers. To sum it up, what the Black Panthers wanted for their people and others were land, bread, housing, education, clothing, justice, peace, and people's community control of modern technology. Had these demands been met, it would have ensured the liberation, independence, and advancement of the Black community in the United States. However, the imperialist capitalist system is not designed to liberate the oppressed, but to gain the ultimate benefit from their oppression.
Well, I would like to welcome a former U.S. political prisoner to Hidden Files, who was incarcerated for 49 years.
Jalil Montarem, former member of the Black Panthers Party, which he joined at 16, and founding member of the Jericho Movement for Political Prisoners. He was incarcerated at age 19, and he was freed at age 69. He spent almost 15 years in prison. He was released in October of 2020. Jalil Montarem established the first revolutionary newspaper from prison and continues to be active. He started From Inside Prison, a national campaign to recognize political prisoners. He also started a UN petition against the U.S. having political prisoners.
Well, thank you for joining us here at Hidden Files, Mr. Montarem. How do you define a political prisoner?
How do we create these categories and define who they are as a result of their resistance of being dissenters to a system of white supremacy and capitalist imperialism? For us, our comrades are freedom fighters, right? They identify them as being terrorists. Why they're terrorists? Because they're opposing the ideals and the practices of white supremacy and capitalist imperialism. Right? They are trying to alleviate our oppression, right, by any means necessary, as our hearts, Malik Shabazz, has instructed us, by any means necessary. And so therefore they criminalize us, right, and bring us to criminal court in order to charge us what they call criminal offenses, right, on their books, right, in order to protect their interests, protect the state, right? And so this is the reason why they don't want to identify us as political prisoners, because they criminalize our movement. They criminalize our people. They criminalize our movement. Right? We've been engaging in war against black people since 1619, all right, if you really want to understand it, all right, when they had the black codes, they had Jim Crow, right, and they have mass incarceration, right, the school-to-prison pipeline, right, it's all criminalizing our lives, right, our efforts to be actually totally free and emancipated, right, people. And so that is the reason why they criminalize us, don't want to give us recognition, right, and understanding that there is divisions in this country, right, as a result of white supremacy, capitalist imperialism, class and race divisions in this country, and that there are people grappling with this idea that at some point in time, we have to free ourselves from a system that has been oppressing us for the last 400 years.
Well, from your experience, do you think that political prisoners are treated differently than the average prisoner?
We find that political prisoners are naturally distinguished from the regular general prison population. And the reason why, because they're educated. They're educated and they understand the nature of their relationship to the state. And therefore, they try to remove those individuals from the population because they do not want the general population to be educated and understand what is their relationship to the state in regards to being an antagonistic relationship they have with the state, particularly based upon race and class. And so for me, naturally, being an organizer in prison, I haven't been organized outside prison, been organized inside prison, I often was targeted by prison officials to be put in solitary confinement and or have other types of harassments and being deprived of certain privileges that most prisoners get. They would deprive me of that. But the only thing that did make me stronger, made me fight harder, that's all.
Well, do you think that it has been proven to the international community that political prisoners exist in the U.S., though Washington denies it?
Excellent question. You are absolutely correct. The United States does not recognize the fact that they do have political prisoners. When I first put in my, I'll give you an example. When I first submitted my campaign, U.S. Petition campaign to the United Nations, this was back in the late 1970s, early 1980s, I had the opportunity to have a question asked of then UN ambassador to the United Nations by a guy named by the name of Andrew Young, the first black UN ambassador to the United Nations under the presidency of Jimmy Carter. And the question I had asked him by a journalist who was, when he was in Paris having a press conference, was, does political prisoners exist in the United States? And Andrew Young answered in the affirmative, positively, said perhaps thousands. You can Google New York Times, Andrew Young, political prisoners, and all those articles will come up. He was vilified in the press, vilified by the elite for having made that truthful statement, and perhaps thousands of political prisoners in the United States. And he was called to the carpet in the White House and told him to shut that down. Why do they do that? They do that because they don't want the world to know that there is dissent in the United States, right? They project themselves as being the moral humanitarian leader of the world. And that is a false, that's a falsehood, right? They are the greatest harbinger of and progeny of violence in the world. Not my words, those are the words of Dr. Martin Luther King prior to his being assassinated. He said the United States is the greatest progenitor of violence in the world. And we understand that, we know that.
Well, do you see a connection between the oppression of black Americans and the oppression of people worldwide?
One of the things I told the community, international community, that their freedom depends mostly on our freedom, right? Black people's freedom in the United States, right? I informed them specifically that when we are free, you will be free, right? Mm-hmm. Why is that? Because we are in the bastion of white supremacy, you see? And so for us, if this empire, what we call the United States, which is in fact is an empire, right? Well, an octopus, right? You can see the tentacles all over the world, right? Where they're sucking the blood and sucking the resources and sucking the labor from various, particularly mostly, people of color countries around the world, all right? Now, those who engage in struggles for national liberation and independence, to end colonialism, neocolonialism, oftentimes they'll cut off the tentacles, right, of the octopus, right, to free themselves. But what happens? The tentacles grow back, right? At a period of time, the tentacles grow back, like what happened in Chile, in Salvador Allende, right, mm-hmm. As an example, when Pinochet took over after they freed themselves. And the same thing happens in various other parts of the world. Why is that? Because the head has not been dealt with. The head of the octopus, right? We are in the head of the octopus, okay? So therefore, as long as the head of the octopus maintains itself, right, then they continue to create the conditions from which they can reassert themselves in those struggles, in those moves that were successful at some point in time. All right, so for us, it is imperative that the world know that the international community, progressive international community, understands that what they're dealing with around the world is white supremacy, capitalist imperialism, but we're in the bastion. We're in the heart of it, right? We're in the belly of the beast. And therefore, our struggle, ultimately, when we are successful, inshallah, when we are successful, the world will also be free.
Well, fortunately, you are no longer in prison, but can you tell us more about the overall conditions of these prisoners even as we speak?
Imam Jamil Al-Amin, right, who they know is innocent of the crime that he committed, but because of his history of resistance, they had to lock him in the prison system, right? He's been in ever since, almost 22 years now, right? They know he's innocent. The guy who committed the crime for which he was convicted of confessed, all right? But they hold him in prison because of his politics or who he is as a political person. Another individual is Varon Zambaro, right? This individual was part of Black Liberation Army, part of the movement back in the days. He did his time, was on his way out the front door, had gotten parole, had received parole on his way out the front door. And Anthony Gonzalez, who was Attorney General of the United States at the time, called the prison and told them, don't release him. He's still in prison today, right, because of his politics. Not because of anything else he's done on. He did his time. He guaranteed parole, right, and they won't let him go, won't release him. Another individual, of course, is Rochelle McGee. Rochelle McGee is the oldest political prisoner that we have in the United States today, right? And he was involved in the 1970 insurrection, August 1970 insurrection with Jonathan Jackson, George's younger brother, at the Bruin County Courthouse, right? He was found not guilty of shooting and even involved in that incident. Not guilty by the court. The court would not accept that decision from the jury. Would not accept it, right? He's still in prison today, right? Mumia Abdul-Jamal, We know that he did not commit the crime for which he was committed. He's known around the world as a profound intellect, right, inside prison.